Thank you. Recorded May 8, 1928, for the RCA Victor Company. And I think I will have our guest, Charles Rosen, tell us what we heard and who we heard.
Well, it's the arrangement of the Blue Danube played by Moritz Rosenthal. He was my teacher, but that was 11 years before I met him. I mean, actually,
Moritz
I met him in 1939.
So he was already, when you met him, he was already 77 years old or 76 years old.
Yeah, well, I was 11 at the time, and I was at Juilliard. So I left Juilliard to study with him and with his wife. But he was hardly playing in public anymore. I did hear him play because he occasionally used to play a few things for me. But it was amazing. I figured either somebody is supposed to have said, either Anton Rubinstein or Joseph Hoffman, that they didn't know what piano technique was before they heard Rosenthal.
Rosenthal, of course, had been a pupil for 10 years of Franz Liszt, and you were a pupil of Moritz Rosenthal.
His wife was a Lechetitsky pupil, so
right.
It was the great German, in Viennese tradition.
Right.
I was, of course, the good Viennese who left in 1938. That's how I met them. Hitler, of course, was an enormous benefit to America. I mean, he gave us nuclear physics and all sorts of things, but art history and musicology, and, of course, some of the great musicians all came to America, and Rosenthal was one of them. And he used to live in the Great Northern Hotel, which was down the street from Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
In a hotel, actually, Metropolis lived there, too, with
right.
a lot of musicians. And so.
How did you come to have the opportunity to work with him?
We had the same dentist. They asked him that. Told Rosenthal, and Rosenthal said I should come and play for him, so I came and play, and he said that he would agree to teach me. And that I was supposed to get one lesson a month with him and one lesson a week with her, but he wasn't playing very much, and he liked me. So practically every lesson with her, she would say, I'll go in and amuse the old man. And I would so go and see him, and he liked to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I played a lot for him, and that he actually pleased. It was very funny. It was I was, 11, 12 years old, and he never said I was wrong. He would say politely, I have a different idea of this piece, he would say. And then he would go to the piano and start showing me. And there was one occasion, maybe it's a funny story, that I was doing the Handel Brahms variations. He knew Brahms very well. He studied with Liszt, as you said, but I never found out what Liszt teaching was like. The only thing I could learn from Rosenthal about Liszt teaching was that it was difficult to get Liszt out of the cafe and back to the studio to get a lesson. That's all I know about the teaching procedure. But he talked a lot about Brahms. And I was playing the Handel variations. I must have been 14 by then. And he stopped me and said, why do you get faster there? And I said, well, it's written poco più mosso. And he always listened. He didn't listen like a lot of teachers within, right at the edge of the piano. He would sit about 2 yards away. He got up and walked slowly to the keyboard and looked at the music. And he said, that Brahms let me play this any way I wanted, and I abused the privilege. You are quite right, and then sat down again. he was a terribly nice man. Is that to me? He was famous for making nasty remarks about other pianists, but that was sort of Viennese humor.
Right.
I mean, he was Polish, but he lived most of his life in Vienna. And the famous jokes. I mean, there was the famous one about Schnabel, of course. Schnabel was rejected for military service in the First World War, and Rosenthal said, of course, no fingers.
That really is a Viennese kind
of
thing.
I heard somebody play at a salon, play the Etude in Thirds, and Rosenthal patted him on the back and said, that's fine, now you have the tempo, you can put in the thirds. he couldn't resist.
With a child, as you were, I mean, he didn't have that side, or did he?
No, well, he liked me. I mean, he was also, he sort of understood my interest. So I know when I was 14, he suddenly said, you better bring the Hammerklavier to me. He said, start with the fugue and bring me an analysis of the fugue. He didn't mean a real analysis. I wanted to make sure that I knew when the theme was played inverted, when it was played backwards, it was played in stretto. It was very simple. He wanted to make sure that I understood what was in the piece, and that he himself was very interested in music in that way. And he was a very cultivated man. That he still read Greek when, you know, when I knew him. That I know, what's his name? Horshovsky once said that he met Rosenthal and thought they would talk about music, and all Rosenthal wanted to talk about was Latin poetry. I mean, that's sort of weird.
It's on so many levels, not just the strict chronology. He was coming from another world. I mean, coming from Lemberg, yeah, well, you know, coming from the Austro-Hungarian monarchy.
The sad thing, I mean, the pianists of that time were really great. I mean, I used to hear Joseph Hoffmann, who was probably mm-hmm. the greatest of all. Every year, from when I was 4 years old until his last concert, and I went with Rosenthal to Hoffmann's last public recital. Mm-hmm. Because his wife was sick, I mean, Rosenthal's wife, and asked me if I would take him. I was in a box with Levine on one side and Rosenthal on the other. I mean, Hoffmann played Opus 31, number 3 of Beethoven, and after the scherzo, Rosenthal turned to Levine and said, too fast. And then after the minuet, Levine turned to Rosenthal and said, too slow. And it was very fun. I remember that concert because Hoffmann came out with the program so he could see what he was playing that evening. He would sort of look at it after every piece. And but I used to hear Hoffmann every year, and so he was great. And it was amazing that. But what happens? None of these pianists recorded the works for which they were greatest.
Right.
Actually,
right.
I mean, because they didn't record long works. They only mm-hmm. recorded encores.
Right.
I mean, basically, that 4 minute pieces.
Right.
And so, I mean, Rosenthal was famous for the Paganini Variations, which Brahms had asked him to play. Mm. He was famous for the Schumann Fantasy. These were the great works that he played. Hoffmann, you know, made great performances of the Reminiscences of Don Juan, mm-hmm. Performance which was absolutely fabulous. I heard him do the Schumann F-sharp minor sonata, the B minor sonata of Chopin. They didn't record that in the 30s, but he refused to let it out because it wasn't good enough. The records that Hoffmann made in 1924, which are the last ones he really made, because he hated recording, mm-hmm. do show him at his best. And some people say that, you know, that you should listen to the recordings that were taped of his concerts to show him it more typical. That's not true. That's unfair. He knew what was the kind of performance that you could listen to 5 or 10 times, not just a sort of once.
Would you say that's true of his concerto performances?
The 1924 recordings, like the two sonatas by Scarlatti, the Gavotte from Gluck's Alceste, and the C-sharp minor waltz of Chopin are impeccable. But impeccable not in the sense that they have all the right notes.
Right.
But what happens is the variety of tone color was unparalleled in history, as far as I know. He could do that, and that... There's a funny letter of Rachmaninoff. Somebody showed me. Somebody had asked him, who's the greatest violinist, who's the greatest pianist, who's the greatest conductor? And he wrote, the greatest violinist is Fritz Kreisler, but Heifetz is almost as good. He's the greatest pianist, when he's in the mood, is Joseph Hoffmann, because you wouldn't recognize him otherwise as great Hoffmann and so on. He said, some people think that Horowitz... will be that great, but up till now he's just been able to play octaves. But maybe since he's married the daughter of the greatest conductor, he will improve a little. It's a very funny letter. But I mean, is that... I mean, Rachmaninoff, you know, dedicated the third piano concerto to Hoffmann, who never played it.
Mm-hmm.
And asked him why he said too many notes.
Right.
The fact is that Hoffmann was dyslexic.
Mm.
He had...
He
had a problem reading music, so... Mm. He had an enormous repertoire, and it was all the works that he learned before he was 20, because before he was 20 years old, he had only to read the piece once if he succeeded, and then he had it for the rest of his life. And Harold Schoenberg told me that, so with Hoffmann, that he'd seen these posters in Odessa of 32 Beethoven sonatas played by Joseph Hoffmann, looked at the date, and Hoffmann was 12.
And he was playing the complete sonatas.
Yeah. I mean, but what happened? None of these pianists, they didn't. Unfortunately, we do not know what they really played like.
Mm-hmm.
Hoffmann at his greatest, with the pieces that I heard him do, which were fabulous. I did hear the Don Juan Fantasy, and somebody who who knew about this said, I know about that performance. Hoffman walked off, said, that's the first time I played the piece the way I really wanted. Mm. And I heard him do the B minor sonata at a performance that Rachmaninoff was there. And when it was finished, Rachmaninoff turned to a friend of mine and said, another piece I have to strike from my repertoire. And so, I mean, these were really great. I mean, that and so on. And, but we don't have any real testimony to that. A few, the only one of the Hoffman taped recitals that shows the way he could actually play is one of the C minor nocturne of Chopin, which has that kind of beauty and kind of perfection that he wanted on his records.
And what about his concerto performances that were captured?
Well, I don't remember. He did some things for television. I don't know that very well. Mm-hmm. And so that,
While you were studying with Rosenthal, while you were going to recitals and concerts of Hoffman and Levine and others, were you also socializing with your former Juilliard classmates, or were you living a kind of double life as a kid pianist with these marvelous emigre friends?
No. I left Juilliard when I was 11.
Right.
So I didn't really have any contact with the kind of conservatory life, which is very useful. Like, you get to play with other musicians, you get to play a lot of chamber music, which I love doing, but I didn't get that much. I did study. Rosenthal refused to teach me if I didn't study harmony and counterpoint, which I studied with Carl Weigel, mm-hmm. who was a Mahler assistant and quite a good composer. So I did get, and I was taught by Weigel to read figured bass at the piano, which is quite useful mm-hmm. if you're playing the musical offering that Bach. But so I may have missed this kind of socializing with other pianists and violinists and so on. Basically, it changed my life a little bit because most of the musicians that I really knew very well were composers. Mm-hmm. When I was at Princeton, Milton Babbitt was really a friend. I used to spend a lot of time going to his house. And Elliot Carter is a close friend. And, you know, one piece was written for me with other pianists. And so I played everything he did. And but I mean, basically, I sort of knew almost all the American composers and Italian, German, French, and English and French. We worked a lot with Boulez and played.
We'll come to that.
It's very funny. I lived across the street from Messiaen, but I don't really like Messiaen. So I've never met him. I didn't even know he lived across the street.
Really? In Paris?
In Paris,
Right.
And Italian composers, I mean, I really did know quite. Mm-hmm. I knew Luciano Berio very well.
Right.
I mean, met Dello Piccola, was it Luigi Nono? And so, I mean, I knew composers more than anything.
But
I was interested in contemporary music, so that was quite useful for me.
So this dentist made a better pairing than he ever could have known, because not only have you had a lifelong fascination with the piano, but you have had a lifelong fascination with the intellectual life and history and the creation of music and the creation mm-hmm. of art. And perhaps if you had been stuck in the conservatory, of course you would have still come to all of those things, but it might have taken longer, and perhaps it would have been a more frustrating route for you.
I don't know. I mean, this is that the all this speculation on what might have been. I mean, it's a terrific French expression, which is that if my aunt had them, she'd be my uncle. But I don't know if you can broadcast that.
Do you? We can broadcast that because you said it. Perhaps this is along the same line, but what do you see as the chickens and what the eggs in this combined life of about three careers, simultaneous careers that you've had as a historian, as a critic, as a pianist, as a teacher, as a lecturer?
Well, I never, I've written books. I never wrote a book before I was 40. Mm-hmm. I mean, as for a teaching job, I never. The first teaching job, I occasionally used to be artist in residence somewhere, you know, like Davis, California, or I did teach one semester at Austin, Texas, and that. But I was traveling a lot. I had to keep leaving. But I mean, the first time I had a job was in 19, 72, so that I was over 40, and mm-hmm. so on. And that was just after I'd written The Classical Style, which was the first book I wrote. So up till then, the only thing I wrote were sleeve notes for my records, largely to keep nonsense off the records.
Right, but even those notes were known, and there were many people who wanted to see you write a book.
Somebody asked me to write a book. So
right,
that.
Right.
So that was, but I mean, I didn't really have any kind of a literary career until I was way into my 40s, and so mm-hmm. That actually is that it depends on how one works. That there's some pianists who practice very little. Casa de Sue, for example, only practice 1 or 2 hours a day.
Really?
Rosenthal once told me when I was 15, he said, if you have to practice more than 2 hours a day, you'll never be a pianist. I have to practice 4. So maybe it's just a little bit.
When do you sleep?
I'm sure he practiced for much more when he was young. You know,
yeah.
But I mean, Serkin always practiced about 8 hours a day,
of course,
it's a very different kind of playing from Casa de Sue. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a kind mm-hmm. of where you feel that Serkin's great performance have been sort of hammered out at a forge, so to speak.
Right.
So, but what happens? I practice 3 to 4 hours a day, but that always left some time to do something else, and that I sort of learned that when I was at university, I majored in French literature, largely because the head of the French department was the most amusing professor that I knew, and I was too proud to do it in music, which was too easy. And but I could practice 3-4 hours a day at the university, and I had a good time. And then they went through and got a PhD, and then they threw me out because I had to go somewhere else and do something, find another way to make a living, which finally, after a few years, I got a contract with Columbia Artist Management, and then I didn't do anything else except play the piano for a long time, or write sleeve notes for the records.
Well, and I imagine you were reading a lot too.
Yeah, well, I always liked reading, but I mean, as I said, if you work, I can play the piano for 8 to 10 hours a day, but I can't really practice more than about 3 or 4. Mm. There are no returns, so to speak. Things don't improve. They just. It's like the squirrel turning around in a cage, like that.
Right.
So that's basically what happened.
You talk about some of this in one of your more recent books, Piano Notes, about the combination of skill and spirit and even personality. And of course, you could probably almost guess if you didn't know that Serkin practiced 8 hours a day and that Casa de Sue did not. I mean, because as you said, it matches also the style of playing. It matches the attitude towards the music itself. And perhaps you were able to find a way that combined your interests, your personality, your physical and mental focus and stamina, and that worked out to be 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's I tried to talk about in that book about the different approaches to the keyboard, physically, the approach to the keyboard, because I did insist that the main thing that people should understand is that playing the piano it's not a spiritual delight alone, it's a physical delight. I mean, mm-hmm. you really need the physical contact with the ivories.
Right.
It's actually better if you have ivories than plastic keys. They mm-hmm. actually deteriorate, it spoils the... It spoils the pleasure. If you have an old piano with ivory, it really feels better. You get more traction. And that's not a joke. I was asked to give a lecture on the spirit and technique. There were a whole series of... Jonathan Miller was talking about producing opera, and I forget what. So, but they asked me to do that on playing the piano, and that was the origin of that book. And
then
somebody asked me to turn it into a book. It was just a lecture at the beginning.
Right.
So it got all kinds of other things in, like piano competitions and things like that. Yeah,
we've spoken of Rosenthal and we alluded to Liszt, but why don't we hear some Liszt? From our guest Charles Rosen. There's some people working with him on this, but we'll talk about that later.
Thank you.
The first movement only, alas, Allegro Maestoso, from the first Liszt piano concerto, the E-flat major, recorded at Watford Town Hall, London, 1966. Our guest, Charles Rosen, the pianist, John Pritchard, and the new Philharmonia Orchestra, back when a CBS record was a CBS record. I see Thomas Z. Shepard was the producer of that recording. What is it like for you listening? Do you ever... unless put in this position to listen to your old recordings, and this is from 41 years ago.
I recorded the Liszt, the first concerto, and the Chopin second, which is actually the Chopin first.
Right.
The first movement of the Chopin, I don't play very imaginatively, as I remember. I haven't heard it for a long time, but the second, third movements are fine. And this went very well, but I was quite pleased with that recording. It was the new Philharmonia had been the Philharmonia Orchestra, right, and had been closed down by Walter Legg. And they were determined, still working with Klemperer, actually, most of the time, that to show that they were still a great orchestra and reconstituted themselves. And so I remember we had four sessions to rehearse and record. We never played these pieces with each other. And Pritchard was an amazing conductor. He could do anything. The problem is he was a little bit lazy, is that he made a big career.
Yes.
But, I mean, he could do anything. I mean, he was a great Mozart conductor. He did the best Marriage of Figaro I ever heard. And I played Mozart with him once, too, in Glasgow. And I heard beautiful Brahms. He conducted Rachmaninoff beautifully, did the Elliott Carter variations. He conducted Stockhausen. Mm-hmm. He could do, absolutely anything. And what happens, we had four sessions to rehearse and record, which was normal, one session to rehearse and one session to record each concerto. And we were finished in three. I mean, we were all very proud. I mean, so I must have been playing relatively well, and the orchestra, they were fairly amazing. Is that, for example, there's a passage in that first movement.
Right.
With two violins playing solo with each other, unison. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get two violins to play absolutely in tune with each other. Eight violins is fine. One violin is fine. Two violins generally a disaster. I said to Pritchard that I'd never heard it played that well. He said, I generally don't allow them. I generally take one of them off right away. And I remember playing the slow movement of the Chopin. Before we started the piece, the first oboist turned to the conductor and said, can we have 1 minute, please? And Pritchard, rather surprised, said yes. And the oboist tuned all the wind part chords at the first eight bars of the piece, and then said to Pritchard, all right, and so on. So, I mean, what happened? That they were really very extraordinary.
Yeah, and they would have this level of care.
Yeah,
not
so,
just
I mean,
let's
that
get
this,
out of
this,
here.
I'm sort of pleased at the performance. I said I wish that I'd been more imaginative about the first movement of the Chopin concerto. Mm-hmm. But the slow movement and the last movement are well played of that, so I'm not ashamed of that.
Had you ever worked on the piece with Rosenthal, or did you work on it?
I had to learn this piece for this recording. They wanted to, Columbia. I mean, I'd been working with them for about 4 years. They said they should make a concerto with me, so they wanted to do both Liszt concertos. I said, look, Gilels just recorded both Liszt and Richter both recorded Liszt concertos. And Gary Graffman, another, young American, just recorded both Liszt concertos. You know, why you want two Liszt? Said, you better do something slightly different. I said, how about one Chopin, one Liszt, and so on. So they did that, and then they put the record out with a really hideous cover, some kind of chocolate box thing, and it fell dead in America. But then they reissued the thing, and it was an enormous success. It reissued it as a tape. It had a huge sale on their subsidiary label, and then it came out as a CD, and it sold a lot of records. I got a lot of royalties in the end. I'm not ashamed of that recording at all.
Where do concertos fit into your playing? I think many of us, rightly or wrongly, think of you as a recital artist principally, or a new music artist.
Well, I mean, I've done both. Basically, the thing I've probably been best known for are the Beethoven recordings. Both of them got nominees for awards. But, you know, I did, I've certainly played a lot of concertos. I mean, that.
But I'm just curious in terms of, if I can say the word, philosophical question. I mean, there's so much of your life and work seems to be about the aspects of the purity of the piano and the things that are unique to and about the piano. And I'm just curious how the concerto fits in for you to that.
Well, I don't know. Is that the concerto recordings that I've made, probably the best one is the, along with this list, is probably the Beethoven Fourth, which mm-hmm. I did extremely well. But then I had a problem with the Beethoven concertos because we recorded that in Abbey Road. And I had recorded the last six Beethoven sonatas at Abbey Road. It was a beautiful studio. And the only thing is that between the time I did the sonatas and the concerto, that somebody at EMI decided to record the Mahler Eighth Symphony there, and it was too small a studio for that, so they put a lot of reverberating material on the walls. So what happens when we did the fourth Beethoven concerto, if you got a mix that was satisfactory, they went four tracks, so one track on the piano, one on the strings, one on the winds, and so on, and then one mic that was high up for room ambience. And if you got a balance of these four tracks that was very good for a soft passage, it was extremely noisy and confused in a loud passage. But if you got a good mix for a loud passage, then it was too dry. It didn't have any resonance in the soft passage. It didn't have enough room feel. And actually, this is one of the few recordings I know, because they did the fifth concerto, and I was very upset by the way they edited that. And I said, I sit in on the editing of this, and I said, what we have to do is we have to reduce the room noise. I don't want to change fiddle with the tracks next to the piano, next to the strings, next to the wind instruments. I said, but you have to fix the room. It's the acoustics. So what happens every time there was a crescendo, I made them lower the room track, the ambience mm-hmm. track, about 2 decibels, and then bring it back. I just sat there and did it with them, and that's an actually very satisfactory recording. And I'm sort of pleased. It was a very good orchestra. It was a pickup orchestra, but they had the concertmaster of the BBC and Alan Civil, who was the first horn of the BBC, mm-hmm. probably the greatest horn player I ever heard, and he's playing in that. So,
it's interesting. One can study, one can theorize, one can analyze, one can practice, but the life of the pianist, as these stories remind us, reduces itself very often to practicalities about which you often can't even have any control.
Yeah, well, it's the question. I've made a lot of records. I mean, about over 50, 60 records, something like that. And the real problem is getting a sort of satisfactory sound. And above all, for technique for, you know, that... that for recording, I mean, a number of records, things actually have no, that I've made have no splices at all. I mean, that the funniest one was playing the Hammerklavier at Abbey Road. The first movement, the best performance, was spoiled by somebody walking in the studio after about 10 minutes. So it's an 11-minute piece, the first movement. So first 10 minutes, there are no splices. And the last minute, there are 4 splices because I couldn't get the... But I was going to throw away the first 10 minutes of the best performance I had, so we had to do something like that. And the slow movement has no splice at all, and that's 20 minutes long. So I mean, and actually, there's one record I made with the slow movement of the Schubert A Major Sonata in which it's the first take. I just sat and played it the right way the first time.
But I guess, I mean, beyond just recordings, I mean, the pianist has very little control over what instrument he's going to be playing when he travels or what the hall is going to sound
the tickets are going to be sold. I insist upon knowing what instrument, and I won't record on an instrument I'm not pleased with. And you know, I do insist upon, but, you know, sort of before I record, we make a couple of takes and I listen to the room sound. And with the same thing with broadcasts, I was playing 2 programs for the French radio, and one was an all Schumann program, the Davidson, Lutensen, I forget what else. And then the next day I had to do a lot of Schoenberg and Webern, and that. So I, just to check, I made sure it was the same studio and the same piano, but I made a sort of 2-minute take of one of the Schoenberg pieces, and then I listened to it. I said, but this doesn't sound nearly as good as it sounded yesterday. And they said, well, yesterday that was romantic music. This one is modern music, so we have different microphone placement. I said, yes, he just put back the other one.
Right.
I was reminded me of that famous remark of Schoenberg, who said, my music is not modern, it's just badly played.
Exactly. Are we supposed to arrive in the concert hall after the interval with a different set of ears or sit in a different seat?
No, but it's a very funny. They had this prejudice in Paris that modern music must sound awful.
So let's help it sound awful with the wrong microphones.
Basically, what they meant was that they wanted you to hear every note very clearly with no room resonance.
Right.
They removed the room resonance. Well, of course, basically, I remember when I first played Schoenberg, it was after Rosenthal's death, but I was still studying with his wife. And of course, like every Viennese, she'd never heard any Schoenberg. Believe it or not. Mm. So I brought that, and she listened to it. She said, it sounds terrible. Maybe if you played it like Chopin, it would sound much better.
So, but hadn't she known Schoenberg?
No.
She had not. Oh, okay.
No. What happened? Schoenberg was really hated in Vienna.
I thought she had a theory class with him or something.
I don't think maybe. Is that true?
Yeah, I thought that she...
Anyway,
yeah.
She hated the
But
music.
She didn't know the music.
So
what
happened?
She
didn't really like Chopin. So I started playing in a different way. Oh, she was much better. Actually, you play it like Brahms is what you do. No, it's true. That's what you're doing. Yeah. And very funny. So I brought it a few times. And after the third week, she suddenly said, you know now with the Schoenberg? He said, I find it that... Mozart is too tame now. I can't listen to it anymore.
She's
starting
to
get hooked on this. It's a very fun. Well, it's like what happened to Beethoven when he was first played in Vienna. People were horrified.
Right.
Literally horrified. Right. And then in a letter to Goethe, Zelter, who was Mendelssohn's teacher, said the thing about Beethoven is that people, when they hear him, they're absolutely horrified. And then they become fanatics about his music, like proponents of Greek love. He felt Beethoven was something like some kind of sexual perversion. It's quite literally.
But it does remind us of a very general problem and issue, and that is that when people don't have exposure and they don't have familiarity, they have opinions, and those opinions have nothing to do with what they're actually being asked to think about or to hear or to learn to care about or understand. And if they don't hear modern music, which is now a period rather than contemporary music, how will they ever have any sense of whether it could matter to them?
Well, the real problem is that until the middle of the 20th century, most people became acquainted with music, if they were music lovers, by playing some of it. And that what happened is that it's certainly true about the problems of modernism, that a great deal of modernism was too difficult, Schoenberg, Webern, was too difficult for the amateur really to try, so they never really got to grips with it. It's one of the big problems of what happened. But this is not a problem in music, this is a problem in everything. The only art in which modernism completely triumphed, of course, is painting, because in painting, if you don't like the painting, you don't just move on to the next painter, in a museum, whereas in music, you have to sit there, and if you hate that thing, it's going to last 15 minutes, and you still have to listen to the thing, and so on. And the same thing with the problem with books, modernist literature, I don't really know a lot of people who've read all the way through to the end of Ulysses or
Certainly not
In the Search of Lost Time by Proust. And Remembrance of Things Past used to be called, and but what happens if those who have, you get completely hooked on it.
Right.
It's a big problem. It's harder contemporary modernist art, painting, literature, and so on, is not only more difficult of access, but it's also in many ways disagreeable. It's extremely unpleasant at first experience, but nevertheless, you become passionate about it, so that... And it was an important part of the thing. The reaction against it has not really, as far as I can see, produced any kind of major work. But major works still of the 20th century remain the great works of modernism, literature and painting and music.
Right.
So, and we're stuck with it, which is unfortunate that, in other words, it's easier to appreciate Mozart than Webern, but that if you really want to go on, you have to, So I've tried to come to terms with that too.
We'll talk more about that, but I think to wind up this hour of conversation with Charles Rosen, pianist, author, thinker, talker, we should hear a piece of late modernism or a late piece by a modernist composer, perhaps. This is 90-plus of Elliot Carter. Can you tell us about
how
this came?
Well, it was written for Goffredo Petrassi's 90th birthday, so 90-plus means many happy returns, obviously. So And there are actually 90 strict beats. There's one part of the piece that you hear a very strict beat, which is absolutely metronomic, and then the rest of the piece is completely free with regard to that. But mm-hmm. then at the end, there's the 90 beats get faster and faster just at the very end. So after the 90th, so he was... but Petrucci was very interesting composer, that is, in a way, like Eliot, he became a really interesting composer, not at the beginning of his career. Right. I mean, Eliot is a composer who became fascinating, great work. Like Wagner, when he was about 35, mm-hmm. not before, mm-hmm. Wagner before 35 is pretty terrible.
Right, right.
And Petrucci was only interesting after he was about 40. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very charming man.
Carter loves these uses of games and uses of numbers, sometimes apparent, sometimes hidden. How much of that is apparent to you when working on a score of his, or do you consult with him about any other meanings or ideas he has behind?
Well, I'm only aware. I mean, it's not so much an interest in numbers. He does like to have sort of rhythmic movements simultaneous, which are not really compatible with each other, mm-hmm. but which interact in ways which are very interesting. And so, I mean, he likes to have something like a steady beat and then a completely accelerating beat against it, and that he does that. And I've never analyzed it, everything in total detail, but I like to be aware of some of it because, in other words, that if you have a very steady beat, you like to indicate it with a certain kind of tone color so that it remains absolutely steady and you can, the listener can follow it, and then the free parts, I mean, which Eliot very often wants played with a kind of rubato and does, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he doesn't want the piece played metronomically, but there are places where you have to be metronomic. And but that's also true of Chopin, the beginning of the second scherzo. If you don't play absolutely metronomic, you don't hear that after a long note something is coming on the wrong beat. If it just sounds, if you've been playing with a very free beat, you completely ruin that particular piece. Whereas the rest of the work, what follows on the next page, has to be played with a free beat. So you have to be, you have to, you know, which what you're doing. You have to make sense of the music, basically.
Exactly. Well, listen for the steadiness and then listen for the freedom in 90 plus of Eliot Carter from 1994, when Mr. Carter was just a pup in his late 80s at the time. The piece is about 6 minutes long. It was recorded by our guest, Charles Rosen, in Astoria, Queens in 1996, December of 1996. I want to thank Charles Rosen. We're going to be talking more with him for our program next week. So do listen to us again at that time. But now let's listen to Mr. Rosen speaking through the piano and the music of Eliot Carter, 90 plus. Thank you. the inventiveness, the discipline, the lyricism, the humor that is the music of Elliot Carter, brought to life there by Charles Rosen from a recording when it was released in 1997. Its title was accurate. Elliot Carter, The Complete Music for Piano, came out in Mr. Carter's 90th year. And of course, he's now in his 100th year. He'll be 100 in 2008. Our guest has been Charles Rosen, celebrating his 80th year with a tour of the United States and a number of places around Europe as well. He was our guest in Chicago when he was here to give both a lecture and a recital at our neighbors, Northeastern Illinois University, and was generous enough with his time to sit down with us to talk. The program is Critical Thinking. We have had the production assurance of the always assured Matt DeStefano. We'd also like to thank Don Tate for helping us to find the art of Morris Rosenthal to bring you the first piece we played, the Blue Danube Waltz, and that remarkable 1928 recording of Johann Strauss's waltz masterwork. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think about this or any of our other programs. It's RENTAP, R-E-N-T-A-P, Patner spelled backwards, at AOL.com. We'd like to thank our funders, Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, and Alphawood Foundation, as well as other friends of this program. I'm Andrew Patner. See you next week.